Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The United States Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit is now open according to law. God save the United States and America.
Please be seated. Good afternoon. We have one appeal scheduled for oral argument this afternoon. It is Brian Frederick Jennings versus the Secretary of the Florida Department of Corrections. Linda McDermott is here for the appellant Jennings. Doris Meacham is here for the state. And Ms. McDermott, you may begin your argument.
Good afternoon. Linda McDermott, along with Laura Silva, on behalf of Brian Jennings. The issue before the court is whether Jennings' second-in-time petition filed in the district court is successive within the meaning of 2244B2. And acknowledging that Tompkins is currently the circuit's law and must be followed, the initial issue to be addressed is whether or not this court can revisit Tompkins in light of Bannister. The prior precedent rule requires that in order to overrule or prior precedent, that a Supreme Court decision or an en banc panel of this court would have to undermine or overrule the precedent, and by that, by taking on the actual precise issue that was before the court, that could serve as the opportunity, if it came out, if it's different than what this court had determined in Tompkins, that this court would then be allowed to revisit the issue. So that said, I just wanted to begin with that and talk about how Bannister does in fact conflict with Tompkins on the precise issue of what is a successive or second-in-time petition under 2244B2. Bannister follows Magwood and Panetti, two of the cases that the Supreme Court has taken on related to second-in-time petitions and the interpretation of 2244B2. And in Bannister, the court started with the question of, would a type of later-in-time filing have constituted an abuse of the writ? And they said that that was really the crux of the issue before the court. And then in answering that question, they looked at the Panetti test with the three considerations. What would the implications for habeas be? What was the purpose of AEDPA? And then finally, what was the what had been done historically under the abuse of the writ doctrine? And if you look at that reasoning, it certainly shows that Tompkins was wrongly decided, which another panel of this court had already determined shortly after Tompkins.
But don't we have to, in order to determine that Bannister overrules Tompkins, don't we, in essence, have to find that Bannister has a very specific discussion? Because Tompkins doesn't really apply or have any Brady or Giglio claims that are involved in that case.
In Bannister, correct?
Yes.
Yes.
I mean, don't we have to, in order to find that Bannister overturns or overrules Tompkins, don't we have to have something more than what you're talking about?
I don't think that you have to have the actual legal issue that's before the court in order to reverse Tompkins. I think that if you look at the law from this circuit in Cayley, it is in order to conclude that you're not bound by a prior holding in a light of a Supreme Court case, you must find that the case is clearly on point and that it actually abrogates or directly conflicts with, as opposed to merely weakens, the holding of the prior panel. And I think by seeing what Bannister does in terms of the actual reasoning and the test to apply when you have an issue like this with a second-in-time petition, that shows that Tompkins didn't apply the correct test. And therefore, that's where it's clearly on point. The test was wrong. Tompkins used a different test, a ripeness test, and didn't use those considerations that Panetti used and then Bannister implicated were the correct considerations to apply. So I do think that they have, it is on point in that respect. Also in Tompkins, Tompkins indicated that that Panetti was cabined to only Ford claims and made that very clear, saying that the U.S. Supreme Court had narrowly addressed 2244B2 and found that that incompetency to be executed claims wouldn't fall into that. However, we know that that's not the case. We know that the U.S. Supreme Court now has said this is the analysis to be used, and clearly Panetti was not just limited to incompetency to be executed claims. So I think that there's specific things about Bannister that reflect on both the holding and the reasoning that are precisely and directly conflict with the opinion in Tompkins.
Our prior precedent rule is, it's pretty strict. And so your argument, as I understand it, is that Bannister, the reasoning of Bannister, abrogates Tompkins. But the two, Rule 59 and, the rules governing second and successive petitions are procedurally distinct rules. They're just different. It seems to me it's going to be difficult to go around it if, you've got two procedurally distinct rules here. And Bannister is pretty much limited to Rule 59 e-motions.
I acknowledge that, Your Honor, but I think that the fact that it shows that Tompkins didn't even do the correct test is the problem, because Tompkins should have no weight if they didn't apply the correct test. And so really what Bannister does, it's not necessarily about the specific thing that it's looking at, the claim or the argument that's being made that why something should be held to be second or successive under 2244B. It's really about, was this test done correctly?
But you say Tompkins didn't use the correct test. What if it's a Brady claim that could have been discovered in the exercise of reasonable diligence? That would be barred, wouldn't it, as a second or successive claim, if the Brady claim could have, in the exercise of reasonable diligence, could have been discovered by the prisoner?
Well, I mean, that takes us into the actual analysis, and I agree, because if you look at the abuse of the writ doctrine, there were Brady claims who made it through in second in time, third in time, fourth in time petitions, and then there were Brady claims that didn't make it through. And that was because the courts held that if cause could be established and prejudice, it could get through and it wouldn't fall to the abuse of the writ. So that's why Tompkins got it wrong, is because they didn't do this analysis. It never got to the Brady claim because it said Brady claims are excluded from 2244B automatically excludes them from a second in time petition. And we know that that is not that is a flawed decision. The reasoning is not correct. The correct test was not applied.
Because of Bannister. That's incorrect. You're saying because of Bannister?
Because of Bannister, right, correct. I mean, because we now have this test that's no longer cabin to Ford claims, and is now, the court has made extremely clear, this is the test you would apply if petitioner files a second in time petition.
Wouldn't it be more appropriate for us to go in bank to revisit Tompkins? To revisit the holding in Tompkins?
I mean, I certainly think that that is possible, but I don't think it's necessary. I think that Bannister has done what needs to be done under the prior precedent rule, and it has basically unhinged Tompkins from its reasoning and shown that that's not correct, and that the holding that Brady.
But I guess my issue is, even under your analysis under Cayley that you keep citing to, it still has to be squarely on point. So how exactly is Bannister squarely on point?
Well, it's squarely on point in that the question to be asked when you have a second in time petition in front of you to determine whether it's second in time versus second or successive is this question about whether or not the later in time filing would it constitute an abuse of the writ and the three considerations the court goes through. So that's where it's precisely on point is.
Right, but you're dealing with a case that's talking about a rule of procedure versus particular claims that are, you know, there's no other circuit that has gone the other way than other than Tompkins is the same for every circuit that's addressed it, unless I'm wrong, and there's another circuit that's gone a different way.
Well, the circuits are somewhat, it's not just cut and dried that the circuits are all one way or the other. I will acknowledge certainly that many of the circuits have relied on Tompkins, Wagenstall out of the Sixth Circuit for one, and we have Tenth Circuit cases, Ninth Circuit cases. But what I do want to make a point of about those cases is those cases, in each one of those precedents, the courts found a different way for the petitioner's Brady claim to be heard. In Wagenstall, I think they allowed the successive petition to go forward. In Brown, out of the Ninth, I believe they allowed the petition, the claim to go forward as a 60B. And so in this circuit, we have extremely restrictive opinions about 60B and about successive petitions going back to the district court to be heard. And so I think that that does change it. We're also seeing more and more judges. One of the judges who was in the majority on Wagenstall, Judge Moore out of the Sixth Circuit, has now indicated that that case was wrongly decided. So we have, I don't think it's as simple as, there's certainly no direct split in terms of the what if Brady would apply as a second in time, but we're starting to see these fractures, and it's not as simple as just saying that Tompkins wasn't alone. Tompkins is alone on the fact that Panetti only applied to Ford claims. And that was the holding. That was the reason why Tompkins couldn't move forward on his Brady claim, is because that was the interpretation of Panetti. Regardless of what issue is before the court in Bannister, that it clearly is no longer a valid holding. And the reasoning is no longer valid. This ripeness test that was applied, it holds, it just can no longer stand up because it is clearly erroneous in terms of these considerations that were set out in Panetti. The Tompkins court didn't follow, and now Bannister has come along and again reiterated, this is the questions you need to decide. So
I'm sympathetic to your argument because I was on the panel in the Scott case where we disagreed with Tompkins, although we had to apply it. But has any federal court interpreted Bannister in the way that you're advocating here, going beyond Rule 59E?
No one has. This is fairly, I think we're sort of on the forefront of whether or not Bannister has changed all of these types of decisions. But what I would say is that we are seeing, again, some...
But it's not a new case. It's a 2020 case.
Correct, yes.
Right. Yeah. It's not a case that came out last year.
Right. Yeah. And so I think that the other thing, Judge Pryor, just to your point, in terms of whether or not... The Scott decision and how that impacted Tompkins, that we're seeing that in other circuits as well. Like I was saying, in other opinions, we're seeing fractures, we're seeing dissents, and we're seeing different ways to allow people to have access to the court. Whereas in this circuit, we do not have those types of remedies for this overly restrictive rule. And so... this court should review Tompkins and find that it has been overruled by Bannister and that Mr. Jennings' claim is no longer foreclosed by 2244B2. because it's second in time and not second or successive. If you get to that point, then I just wanted to discuss a little bit about the test that you would apply and how Mr. Jennings would meet that test. So the Panetti test had the three considerations: the implications for habeas practice when interpreting 2244, the purpose of AEDPA, and then the pre-AEDPA abuse of the writ doctrine. And I should note that the Scott panel addressed these three considerations, and in the Scott panel's position, this would require that a Brady claim could be considered as a second in time. And it sort of reverted back to the abuse of discretion, the abuse of the writ doctrine as to whether or not the petitioner could show cause and prejudice. So I'll start there at the third consideration. And it has been historically the abuse of the writ doctrine was meant to keep the system open for valid claims. And the question really was, did the petitioner have one full and fair opportunity to raise claims in a prior application? And so the key to that is whether or not a petitioner's proceedings would have been full and fair. And while 2244B2 certainly changed that somewhat, it took the burden off the government to show that there was any prior petition filed or that this was a successive petition. And it also changed the miscarriage of justice exception to the abuse of the writ. So it did change it, but it didn't change it as to the Brady issues and other issues where information was not available at the time of the first petition. So the abuse of the writ looked at, was a claim raised previously? If it was, then, and it had been ruled upon, then it was likely abusive. If it was based on new evidence, then there was this this analysis of whether or not the new evidence was whether the petitioner was diligent in finding the new evidence, and then how that evidence would have affected the claims in the petition. So Brady claims were always open for petitioners to bring second in time. Petitions cause in our legal sort of in more than just the abuse of the writ doctrine, but also in our exhaustion cases. Cause can be found if there's state impediment or state misconduct. And so that is the crux of the Brady Giglio due process violations that that would be coming at a later date, potentially, because of the disclosure of information that had not been disclosed at the time of the trial. So the test, this court said in Alderman, the test was, is the external impediment that prevented filing with the initial petition of evidence not reasonably available to the petitioner? And this is exactly the case that we have here in Mr. Jennings' case, where evidence surfaced after the fact about a critical state witness, Clarence Musinski, who was a state informant, jailhouse informant, who came forward and, unbeknownst to Mr. Jennings, he had been convicted of first-degree murder. The jury had recommended a sentence of life, and the prosecutor still persisted in wanting to seek death and ask for the judicial override in Mr. Musinski's claim. It was shortly after the jury decided to recommend life for Mr. Musinski that he then approached the state when he found out that he was still going to be, the death penalty was still going to be sought in his case. So
does the record reflect when Mr. Jennings learned of this Brady claim?
So at the evidentiary hearing below, there was testimony about the attorney from the Netherlands who had been involved in Mr. Jennings' case and his communications with Musinski. And he indicated that it was based on those conversations that he learned about the PSI, which clearly reflects that the state was still requesting a death sentence even after the jury recommended life, and that he learned about the fact that Mr. Musinski's then wife had been charged with perjury in relation to her testimony in Mr. Musinski's case, and she had been arrested and was in the same jail as Mr. Musinski. And so...
And what was the answer? Because you didn't answer the question, which is when did he learn of it, i.e. in time?
So he learned of it when that individual...
What time? What year was that?
I believe it was... Well, it was timely filed in terms of when the...
It's just a simple question. What year was it?
I don't know the date off the top of my head. We were at the hearing, and I believe it was...
Do we know how long after his first 2254 motion was filed?
Yeah, yes, Your Honor. I mean, everything was filed within the time of when it would be filed. And I guess I should also say that at the evidentiary hearing, the state waived any reliance on diligence in that hearing, I guess acknowledging that the claim would have been not just timely, but that it had just been disclosed.
Right, but you're alleging a Brady violation, right? So how is that evidence exculpatory?
How is the evidence exculpatory?
Is it exculpatory? Is it impeaching? What is your position on that?
Well, it's exculpatory because it is impeaching, and it was impeaching of...
How is it exculpatory when your client's footprints match the victim's house? I mean, there's fingerprints, there were other things. So exactly how is exculpatory of the underlying crime that he was found guilty of?
Well, if you look back at the first direct appeal, there were three different trials in this case. And after the first direct appeal, the Florida Supreme Court indicated that there was some opportunity for Mr. Jennings to argue less than first-degree murder. And because the error at that time was that the public defender's office represented both one of the witnesses against Mr. Jennings as
right, but
well.
Not this particular person.
Not this particular
right, so
person.
So I'm asking you again, how is the evidence here, the Brady evidence that you say it's a violation of Brady, how is it helpful? How does it meet the prima facie elements for Brady?
Correct. Well, let me start at the easiest spot, and that would be as to Mr. Jennings' death sentence. Musinski was largely relied upon, if you look at the facts underpinning both the heinous, atrocious, and cruel aggravator and the cold, calculated, and premeditated factor. And so there were three aggravators in this case. The other one was a status aggravator of...
Right, but even if you take out Mr. Musinski, you had Billy Crisco and Alan Krueger, who also heard Mr. Jennings confess to the crimes, and they also provided testimony, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor, but I think that the entire crux of how you do the Brady analysis is not based on just whether or not the individual would have been found guilty. You have to look at all of the evidence, including the fact that all three of those witnesses were impeached at trial, and since then, other types of exculpatory evidence has surfaced, for example, with Alan Krueger.
But again, one of the elements or one of the factors is that prejudice ensued. So I'm having difficulty understanding how there was prejudice when you have... overwhelming evidence.
Well, as to those aggravators, I would say that they were largely dependent on Musinski. And so if Musinski's credibility was at issue, then the jury should have been able to know specifically what was motivating his testimony. The death penalty, many courts have indicated the death penalty is a highly motivating factor for witnesses to testify falsely against people facing the death penalty. So I would say that, and also having his wife in prison or in jail with him, that would be another factor. And so there were a lot of different credibility challenges to these various witnesses. But I do think that if you look at the specifics of the penalty phase claim, that is where most importantly the Mr. Musinski's credibility would have been at issue, since he was one of the only witness to provide some of those details that were used in obtaining a death sentence and then upholding a death sentence. And then all through the litigation on the initial federal habeas, Judge Hinkle, when he found that cold, calculated, and premeditated aggravator was a violation of ex post facto, he then resorted to looking at the fact that there was still the heinous, atrocious, and cruel aggravator, which, again, that relies largely on Musinski. So if you'd have to go back and look at each proceeding, including the trial proceedings, and then that would be the cumulative review and the analysis that would be done in under Brady to determine whether prejudice had ensued. And I would argue that it has, certainly as far as the sentence of Mr. Jennings. I see I've gone over my initial time. May I reserve time?
All right. Thank you, Ms. McDermott. We'll hear from Ms. Meacham on behalf of the state.
Good afternoon. Doris Meacham on behalf of the state of Florida. May it please the court. I want to touch on, since what she left on with the Brady claim down below, there was actually an evidentiary hearing on the claim regarding the PSI and the allegedly Brady material regarding his wife. And the court determines that there was no Brady violation. The PSI information was readily available to defense by the time of the third trial, which is when Mr. Musinski testified. At that time, his case was closed and it was a matter of public record. That's what the trial court stated as far as that was concerned. As far as whether or not the Brady violation, if there had been one, would have changed the outcome of the case, the court noted that it would not have, and also noted that the recantation by Mr. Musinski was unbelievable. He contradicted himself on his original statements that he made. He had names of prosecutors that didn't exist. So again, the trial court did not find that there was any Brady violation, or it would have changed the outcome of the case, given the facts of this case, which I think Mr. Jennings' case is a prime example of why we have the gatekeeping requirements of 2244.
But of course, we would review that decision if his claim, if he was able to file his claim.
He did not. And that's what I'd like to point out is...
But if we have jurisdiction because the claim is not barred, then this court would review that decision, right? Right.
Okay. But we're not there yet.
Okay.
Because as the district court held below, which they dismissed the petition due to lack of jurisdiction, under this court's binding precedent.
What do we know from the record when this Brady claim ripened in connection to his first habeas petition? It was after, right?
The Brady claim ripened at trial, and that is the holding of Tompkins. That is what establishes a Brady claim as successive.
Before he filed his original petitions at trial, the Brady claim ripened at trial?
Everything that he claims occurred would have occurred at trial. When you look at a Brady claim, it has three components, as Your Honor stated. The first one is that the material evidence at issue must be impeaching or exculpatory. The second component is that it had to have been either inadvertently or willfully suppressed by the government. And the third component is prejudice.
The issue that's presented, though, for us now is whether or not Bannister abrogates our decision in Tompkins, right?
Right. And
that's the issue for us to decide. And it's, and I guess what I'm trying to figure out is, doesn't it depend on when the claim ripens? Isn't that the critical determination? Because if a Brady claim cannot be discovered in the exercise of reasonable diligence until later, then it seems like it's just like a Ford claim. And so therefore it would not be barred, right?
It is not like a Ford claim.
What did you say? I didn't hear you there.
It is not like a Ford claim because a factual predicate, the factual predicate in a Brady claim is the suppression of the evidence. The fact that it was discovered late in time is a reason or an excuse to get past the gatekeeping requirements. If you look at 2244B, so it specifically says...
What if the government holds on to exculpatory evidence until after the prisoner files his first petition and just holds on to it, and then after that says, oh, by the way, I have exculpatory evidence that was suppressed? What does the petitioner do then?
He follows the process of the court, which is
what?
To seek. He follows the process that is established here. Mr. Jennings has
He files an application for a successive petition.
He files an application authorization with this court, gets authorization from this court to file.
And then if we follow Tompkins, we say, well, no, it's not like a Ford claim. You can't file it. You can't file it because Panetti is limited to Ford claims and not Brady claims.
I understand, but under 2244, if you look at the language, the plain text of that is designed for newly discovered claims. It's designed for Brady claims because the first obstacle is the factual predicate for the claim could not have been discovered previously through the exercise of due diligence. That's what we have here.
That's what I'm asking about. What if it could not have been discovered in the exercise of due diligence until after he filed his initial habeas petition? Then it seems to me that it's just like a Ford claim then.
It is not, because the Ford claim is an incompetence issue, whether or not he's competent to be executed. The factual predicate is a competency that just is established now. It's ripe now because he's ready to be executed, and the mental state at that time before execution is what makes it ripe.
I guess my concern is that the Supreme Court says, yeah, we're going to make an exception for mental incompetency claims because they can't be discovered until later. What if it's a Brady claim that can't be discovered until later, too? Then why shouldn't that same analysis apply?
Right, but the Brady claim was discovered after the trial. At the time of trial, he was competent for trial.
In this case, you're arguing, but what if it's not discovered until later?
As far as the Brady claim or the incompetence?
The Brady claim.
The Brady claim, if it's not discovered until after the first habeas petition, then there is still a process for him to follow. He can file his successive petition if he meets the gatekeeping requirements.
You're saying he still has to come to the appellate court to ask for a COA?
Which is what he should have done.
Right.
And that's what he had an avenue. He was supposed to come here first, seek authorization, mm-hmm. and then if he met the gatekeeping requirements, then he could go forward with his claim.
Can I ask you, because I just want to procedurally understand. So when he files, I think he files the first habeas, was it in 2008 perhaps, the federal one? Or 2002, I think is when he did his first one?
The first one, let's see. I think it was around 2002.
Let's see. I just ask because there's been a lot of appeals in this.
There has been many.
The Supreme Court vacated the first verdict and sentence, right?
Yes, he had three trials.
So he had three trials?
Three trials.
And the Brady claim here stems from the third trial, or do we know?
The Brady claim stems from the very first trial. They're saying this was suppressed from the get-go, from the trial. They never knew about this evidence, this PSI, which the state would have had from the very beginning of the trial.
So he didn't know about it during the third trial either?
No, that's correct.
All right. So I guess All Brady claims, all second in time Brady claims are barred. That's the position of the state.
Are successive and must meet the gatekeeping requirements of 2244B.
Yeah, that's what we said in Tompkins. And that we criticized in Scott and said it's wrong.
And the argument in that was because the wording of it was that the discovery of it didn't happen until later, and that was a factual predicate. But if you look at the factual predicate of a Brady claim, you cannot use the late discovery as a reason to label it as not successive. You can use it as a reason as to why it was not discovered earlier and apply it towards 2244B.
Why doesn't Jennings make a compelling case that the reasoning in Bannister abrogates Tompkins?
Bannister is completely different than this case. It has nothing to do with what we're here for. In fact, with Bannister, it has to do with a 59E. And what they were looking at in that case was whether or not that rule was trumped by 2244. And what they did was look back at the history of where it came from. And this was a common law practice, which was term of court. You had the ability to change the judgment if there was something wrong with it during your term within a specific amount of time. That's what 59E is about. So they looked at the history of 59E because the term of court then became 59E. And they said that, again, looking at the reasoning behind AEDPA, which is finality, and that rule did not conflict with the purpose of AEDPA. That's the holding of Bannister. And
so Bannister held that the reason behind the bar on second or successive habeas petitions is to prevent abuses of the writ.
Abuse of the writ.
Right. That's what Bannister says.
Right. And that 59E was not in conflict with that.
Right.
Because it was very short. It was the same judgment, was not final,
right,
and it was within 28 days.
Right. But how is it an abuse of the writ when a prisoner brings a Brady claim that was previously unavailable in a numerically second habeas petition?
Because they can still go forward. They're not foreclosed from bringing their claim before the court.
That's not my question. My question is, how would it be an abuse of the writ? And that's the test that Bannister applied.
I think they look at, they also bring up 60B, which is more in line with newly discovered evidence claims. And they did talk about how 60B does have the potential for the abuse of the writ.
Because it has the potential, but in the case of a Brady claim that was previously unavailable, not, right?
It does, because if you look at the facts of this case, if you were to reconsider whether or not Tompkins was decided incorrectly, this would not be the case to do it. If you look at the facts of the case, this was 45 years ago when Mr. Jennings broke into the home of a six-year-old that was sleeping, kidnapped her, took her outside, held her by her legs, smashing her head against the pavement, sexually assaulted her, and then drowned her. The lower court had a hearing on this Brady issue and said that even if all of the Brady claims Jennings had said occurred were given to the jury to consider, it would not change the verdict.
But here we're looking at whether we have jurisdiction, right?
We're not looking at the merits of the claim.
Right,
but and again, binding precedent, Tompkins is still binding. It's still good law. And that means that Brady claims are successive, and Jennings did not go about the correct way. And the lower court dismissed it correctly because it lacked jurisdiction to hear it. As far as Bannister does nothing to overturn the ruling in Tompkins. It's two completely different monsters there. It's the Brady claim versus this very limited issue in Bannister, which was whether or not procedurally 59E was in conflict with AEDPA with 2244, and it held that it didn't because, again, this was a very limited procedure. The judgment was not final. 28 days for the court to change any inconsistencies or any irregularities with their reasoning before it was final. That's not what we have here. This is more in line with 60B motions, which just recently in Mills was upheld as far as if it's newly discovered under 60B, you must follow the procedures, and that's where we're at here. You cannot liken the reasoning in Bannister to the reasoning in Tompkins.
And in Bannister, the judgment was not yet final.
It was not yet final. Right. This is something that's new, that's not done. Not as in this case where we're here, again, 45 years later, reopening this case.
Right, and that's why the rule was a motion to alter or amend the judgment.
Correct.
In Bannister.
In Bannister. Yeah. That's not what we have here either. And again, I think that there's a clear misunderstanding with the failure to discover as a factual predicate in ripeness. The factual predicate of a Brady claim occurs at trial. The factual predicate is the suppression of evidence. With the Brady claim and with the Giglio claim is whether or not the state presented perjured testimony. All of that occurred at trial. Whether or not it was discovered later is a reason to get past the gatekeeping requirements.
Right, you're saying the claim still exists, it's just you have to then file the proper motion before the appellate court to get past gatekeeping.
Correct. There is a procedure in place for Mr. Jennings. He can still follow that procedure. He needs to do it correctly. He needs to get authorization from this court before he can file a petition. And he chose not to do so. And he chose to file in the Middle District. And the court properly dismissed it.
When was the evidentiary hearing on Brady?
Which one? The second one was
the one that's relevant here that said that there was no Brady claim.
So he files his third successive on June 25th, 2012. And they had an evidentiary hearing, and the court filed their written order on June 5th, 2013. And the Florida Supreme Court affirmed on August 28th, 2015. And again, they agreed with the trial court's credibility findings regarding Mr. Mazinski's testimony. And they also agreed that even if that Brady material had been given to the jury, it would not have changed the verdict. And again, as Your Honor noted, there was other testimony. There are two other witnesses that Mr. Jennings confessed to. And in the first two trials, it was Kruger that testified. The only reason he didn't testify in the third trial was because he died.
Right.
But that testimony
was
admitted.
But his testimony was still presented at the third trial.
It was still presented. Yeah. So we have his testimony, we have Mazinski, and we have a third person. We have fingerprints on the windowsill. We have footprint that matches his shoe. We have the wet clothes. And this was a six-year-old child. The medical examiner.
And you also had the testimony from, I don't know if it was the girlfriend, but the woman who saw him afterwards
with
the wet clothes.
With the wet clothes, correct. And although his confession was tossed out for the third trial, the photographs of his penis, which showed injury, was still submitted to the jury. And that, along with the injury that the victim sustained to her vaginal area, was also submitted to the jury. So this isn't a case of actual innocence. This isn't a case of strong Brady material that would have changed the outcome of this verdict. And if there are no other questions, the state would respectfully ask that you affirm the district court's order dismissing Mr. Jennings' petition due to lack of jurisdiction. Thank you.
All
All right. Thank you, Ms. Meacham. Ms. McDermott, you've reserved some time for rebuttal. So if we ever got to a cause prejudice analysis, isn't it clear from the record that there is an abundance of physical evidence in this case over and above the testimonial evidence?
There is evidence of Mr. Jennings' guilt, mm-hmm. Yes. But I do want to make the point that a Brady determination or a Giglio determination, as this claim was raised as, is the prejudice analysis is not outcome determinative. You have to look at what could have been done with the evidence, what the defense attorney may have done. Here there may have been a viable intoxication defense that could have been brought that the defense attorney at the trial chose not to bring. So you would have to go back and look at all of the proceedings, all of the information that surfaced, all of the various Brady information that surfaced from Mr. Jennings' initial 3850 proceedings, and you would look at that to determine whether or not you have confidence in the outcome.
All right. Well, let me ask you this question with the time that you have left now. If this Brady claim ripened earlier, is this the case to reconsider Tompkins?
I think there's this misunderstanding. The suppression of the Brady occurs at trial and all the way until 2011, when Musinski himself reveals to Mr. Stappert that there were other considerations driving his testimony of which the state was aware. He then points Mr. Stappert in the right direction. The documents, Musinski's credibility doesn't matter. We've always said Musinski's a liar. The documents themselves show that he had other significant motivations to testify against Mr. Jennings and provide graphic details that are not supported by the evidence and are inconsistent with his prior statements. And those are the documents that were suppressed. The Brady claim ripens when they're disclosed, because Mr. Jennings cannot bring a Brady claim without having the evidence to bring the Brady claim. He did not know that there was suppression, and he did not know what the suppression entailed. So this idea that the Brady violation occurred at the time of the trial, all that means is simply that the suppression occurred. But without the disclosure, you don't have a claim. And so that's the problem with the Tompkins analysis and the supplanted ripeness test.
So when does the disclosure occur?
The disclosure occurs to Mr. Stappert in 2011. And then following that,
Is that after or before the initial petition?
It's after the initial petition.
Okay.
The initial petition was filed in 2002.
Okay.
So Mr., if you were to continue to uphold Tompkins, mm-hmm. We have essentially a suspension of the writ.
Okay.
The courthouse doors are closed to Mr. Jennings. He cannot meet 2244B2.
Your argument is that the Brady claim doesn't ripen until it's disclosed.
Correct.
Okay.
If there's going to be a discussion about ripeness and the way that it was discussed in Panetti, it was really about what are the implications for habeas. And so in looking at it like that, a claim may ripen after the initial habeas petition. And in cases, particularly in cases where you have prosecutors who may not have revealed exculpatory evidence, that is something also, I think, to be considered in terms of the importance of the various actors' roles and encouraging prosecutors to, certainly we don't want to encourage.
But why does Mr. Jennings not have a viable vehicle still, which is that you file the motion asking for authorization to file a second habeas?
Because as you've pointed out today, Judge, there's evidence, and he could never overcome the actual innocence piece of 2244B2. But as far as a second in time, he would have an opportunity to show that the evidence, whether he's guilty or innocent, could have impacted the adversarial proceedings, and that's what he should have. The only reason he didn't have that opportunity is because the evidence wasn't disclosed to him.
And when was the third trial?
The third trial, I believe the trials happened very quickly. I believe the third trial was in the early 1980s, 1984, perhaps. So, that trial was affirmed in 1987. So, I didn't get a chance to discuss the other considerations that Panetti set forth, and then Bannister made clear are the considerations, the implications to habeas, and the purpose of AEDPA. But the Scott panel did, and I would urge this court to reverse Tompkins, find that Tompkins is no longer good law, and adopt the Scott panel's reasoning of the various factors. I did want to also just clarify that at the time of the evidentiary hearing with this particular evidence, which was in 2012, that the state did acknowledge that Mr. Jennings had been diligent, or that they were not contesting his diligence at that time. So I do think that that also demonstrates that this he didn't abuse the writ in this case. He brought this as soon as he had the opportunity to do so. Bannister upends Tompkins.
But you acknowledge that Bannister involves a judgment that is not yet final, correct?
Yes, but it was insignificant to the analysis that was conducted by the court. The court set forth what the test was. The court followed the test.
Part of ADEPA is the purpose of ADEPA is to create finality. It's easy to have an analysis when the judgment is not yet final, to say it doesn't disrupt that purpose.
I mean, the Scott panel applied
I understand, but Scott also applied and followed Tompkins.
Correct, but I mean, Scott acknowledged the correct test and discussed the finality is what I was going to say. So my time is running short, but I would just say that they did discuss the finality issue and why it doesn't serve finality purposes to allow Brady and due process violations to be excluded from second-in-time petitions. I just conclude by saying that I would request this court find that Bannister's been abrogated, that Bannister abrogates Tompkins, and that you apply the correct analysis to Mr. Jennings' claim in reviewing his due process violations. And if not, then I fear that, like in Castro, there's going to be this absurd result where petitioners can't have Brady claims heard. And the Supreme Court has said that that isn't what the AEDPA intended. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Court is adjourned.